Well, good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, Jean-Marc Grodi, here on EWTN. And once again, we have this great privilege to come together to hear a story of faith and conversion. We're joined by David and Rosanna White. They're former Seventh-day Baptists. And they came to the church in 2021, and we're honored to have them here to share their stories tonight. Rosanna, thanks for being here. And David, so excited to finally have you guys. I know we were trying to get you on last year, and life didn't work out, but here we are. We've got an exciting story to get through today. So, yeah. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. And Rosanna, why don't you start us off with your side of the story?
All right. Well, I was raised in the United Methodist Church. And my dad was a lay speaker in the United Methodist Church and ended up pastoring a church for a while. So I was sort of a pastor's daughter as a teenager. Yeah. And when we got married in college, and my dad felt a real conviction about the Sabbath. Mm-hmm. So he found a Seventh-day Baptist church near where we were going to college. So we went to that, made good friends with
Justin Hibbert and his
wife Carlene, who have also converted to Catholicism. Right. Yeah. So they were good friends of ours. And then when we moved home after college, we actually helped my parents plant a Seventh-day Baptist church. Mm-hmm. And so that's where we raised our kids until we could not deny any longer that it was not where we were supposed to be anymore.
Gotcha. So your background originally is United Methodist.
Yes.
What about you, David?
My background was sort of nothing. Okay. My mother was raised Catholic, Italian Catholic family, you know, fresh, semi-fresh from Italy in the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. And remember having lots of good experiences with my great-grandmother. But I don't know, I wish I had the story about what happened with my grandfather, because he, at some point, must have left the church. I always assumed that I was baptized Catholic, because the whole family had always been. And I assumed it was my mother who was the black sheep that left because she was pressured to, become a sister. And, you know, they wanted a religious in the family, and there weren't any others. So, you know, she had her whole, the period of rebellion, she was in the 60s and 70s. So I assumed that she was the one, but when it came time to come into the church, they said, oh, we need your, records of baptism. It's like, okay, well, I think I was baptized Catholic. Let me go ask. I said, oh, if you were, we can get the records. It'll be easy. I'm like, oh, you're baptized Methodist. I was. It was until that moment, I had no earthly idea that was the truth. Mm-hmm. And, my journey sort of into any sort of organized faith sort of came with
dating
the pastor's daughter.
Yeah.
She wasn't a pastor's daughter yet.
He wasn't a pastor yet.
Right.
But, and then it just was a case I really enjoy, learning the history and understanding the sort of mysterious elements of faith that are both true and unfathomable in a way. And so that was really interesting for me to sort of, you would see glimmers of that in different Protestant churches.
Yeah.
But it's hard, right? Like, there's never the lean into it elements, right? It's, oh, the Spirit was here, now it's gone. How do you feel? I feel good. Try to reclaim that. So I just remember getting really irritated, like that sand in the eye almost feeling, but somewhere deeper, when you have folks, I remember we were teaching because we were involved in the education ministry for this new church plant. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember even what the subject was, but I just talked about Easter. Mm-hmm. And I remember someone saying, I don't believe in that. Christian don't believe in Easter. And I remember just going, we're not going to talk about that right now. let's stay on topic. But that was one of those first seeds where I went, what is going on here? What are we attracting? What is wrong?
Yeah, what are we doing here? What are the grounds for belief? How do we decide such questions?
Yeah.
Let's back up for a minute.
Yeah, please.
Let's get you there. Okay, so how did you guys meet? And so I take it you guys grew up in a similar area. Where was that?
She was dating my best friend.
Oh, okay.
Middle school dating.
Dating. Yeah. So we've known each other since middle school. We started dating in high school. Yeah. actually left high school engaged and went to the same college. We went to St. John's College in Annapolis, where you sit and talk about the great books for 4 years, and sophomore year is all religious.
All the Bible and then the saints.
Yeah, so we joke that a lot of Catholics come out of St. John's. They don't come in Catholics, but a lot of people leave Catholic. So all of our friends from college are Catholic. And
particularly our friends that have stayed friends for now 25 years.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting.
And you entered St. John's, again, having gotten, in your case, back into the faith, and you're involved in ministry. And so you entered now as a married couple. You're probably the odd people out as
very
a married couple
much,
there.
Yeah. We got married after freshman year. Yeah. So we became the married couple on campus.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that afforded us so many opportunities to just have people over and have conversations.
And we were the only one with a kitchen because we had an apartment. So all of the dinner parties happened at our house.
At our house. So it was a great opportunity to meet a lot of folks. And there was just, it's a strange thought. I've had it twice today in coming here. I remember sitting talking in our car to a Mormon who I had just dropped off. And he's like, you know, I think that either Mormonism or Catholicism's right, but nothing in the middle. It's like, okay.
Yeah,
but it was such an interesting, odd intermix of different types of people and thought. And anything was fair game at St. John's. Like that.
Yeah,
that's the rule.
It was all about conversation.
Yeah,
not
yeah.
about being right. It was about learning from the conversation.
So, did you think, and your family, did you think of other Christian groups as they're equally Christian? We just kind of have different flavors. Is that sort of
That's pretty much how most. Like my immediate family was, we have some other denominations in the mix that are less of that mind. But we certainly were always of that mind because we had great friends who were from all sorts of different denominations in the Protestant church and our Catholic friends. So we knew where we had the same foundation. And then we also knew what the differences were. But we also knew when there was something we didn't understand, we could just say, hey, what's up with? And then we could talk about it.
Yeah.
Which was also fascinating on occasion because we would ask those questions to our Catholic friends. And I think they would admit that in college years, they weren't particularly good Catholics and didn't know how to defend a lot of their points.
Yeah.
Martin said, Martin Kadinsky, my now best friend, but he said, I've always claimed to be Catholic, but I went to, I was at work and they said, oh, you're Catholic. When was the last time you were at Mass? And he went,
right.
But like we would ask questions and he would defend things he thought and then have to come back later and go, oh yeah, I was wrong.
And what were you both studying there at St. John's?
Everyone takes the same program.
Oh, I see.
So it's a liberal arts degree, but you study philosophy, history of math and science, physics, linguistics, and comparative literature.
Okay.
So you come out very well-rounded.
Yeah. And lots of good conversations while you were there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and that experience really, I think, taught us how to approach the idea of the different faiths, but we're all, like, the idea of a universal church was, I just took it for granted, I think. And it took me years to realize not everyone does take it for granted that there is a universal church, or at the very least, no. I'm going to stand by that. But there's an assumption that mine is right and yours is wrong. And honestly, that was always also my thought, that the Catholic Church was sort of the mind of, we're always right and you're always wrong. And so that was, you know, a hurdle to occasionally get over was, you know, and I remember, again, Martin saying, we're not right. It's fitting that. I was like, what does that mean, Martin? Come on. Like, you use this phrase. But it was... being able to come at things with an openness and willingness to discuss was just critical.
Yeah.
And having like a common, like, you know, at St. John's, you read one text and then you talk about it from all your different points of view, but you're grounded in the text. And I still remember we were in I don't remember if it was a Bible study or what it was. And we were what book was it we were reading? Do you even remember?
More context.
The one the lady said, and it was literally the words of Christ, right? And she said, well, I just don't believe that. And another moment where I had to go, okay, well, what does that mean? And there have been a handful of those over the years of, I just don't believe that. Okay.
Yeah.
And that itch, that, you know, sand in the eye.
Yeah.
I got to be almost unbearable to live with, I think, there for like a year. Because you said on the way coming here, like, I'm so happy that you're not always like, I don't want to get up and go today. Because that was a certain point of like, I don't know what heretical thing's going to get said today. Mm. Now, I mean, that's an exaggeration, but I probably said it.
Yeah. So would you say that, so how did your faith and your journey progress during your time at St. John's?
I think it was, for me, because I grew up in a church. Yeah. So it was the first time I was really having to examine why I believed the things I did, mm-hmm. and really having daily conversations with people who did not believe the things I did. Yeah. So it was the first time where faith had to become real to me and fully mine from mm-hmm. a reasoned point of view. Like I had lost family members. I had done the whole, it becomes real to me, I need it to rely on, but I hadn't reasoned through it. Mm-hmm. And at St. John's, you have to reason through everything. Mm-hmm. So I remember many times, because I'm a novelist, so I was writing during college as well. And I was writing what became my first published book, A Stray Drop of Blood, that takes place during the time of Christ. And it forced me to really try to live it out as very personal, but also as it would have been when Christ was on the earth. And just through that process, I had to come to so many realizations of how real it is, that it was set during this particular point in history for a reason, mm-hmm. and where society was, what an individual in the society would have been thinking and feeling and struggling with, and the things we take for granted because we've been reading the Bible for 2,000 years now, right. were new and strange. And, you know, we read the miracles and we're like, oh, Jesus fed 5,000. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine being one of those people going, seriously, is this a fish story? You really expect me to believe that this guy fed 5,000 people with a couple loaves and fish? And so it just made me take it inside myself in a new way, mm-hmm. and became so real, but also because I was seeing different perspectives for the first time and realizing what Christianity did for the world and how society today is what it is because of this strange religion that came around,
right.
and just turned the world on its head.
Yeah, the historical perspective is an important piece of so many people's journeys, because you can grow up with sort of, a general sense of Christianity and a general but somewhat mythical sense that it's historical, but it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But then certain things kind of push you to begin to realize, we actually do have a historical faith. We believe certain things happened at certain times in certain places. And then that brings up a lot of additional questions, like what's happened since then? How did we get from there to here, right?
Yep.
Yeah. But in one of the things that you were saying about like putting yourself in that position is we don't always, we take for granted the lessons that we think we've learned from history, mm-hmm. and from the church, but there's who would you have been in that time? Mm. You know, would you have been more like the Pharisees? Would you have been, you know, would you have been an apostle? Let's be honest. Everybody says, oh, I would have totally been a follower of Jesus. Really?
Because not everybody was.
You know, most of the people heard some things and went, I'm out.
Yeah.
And so that idea of put yourself there, but people are people. They have the same problems now that they had then, you know, within some bounds. Like humans are humans. We have the same emotions. We have the same desires and needs. Mm-hmm. So that's really helpful to think about it like that and realize the writers, not just like writers of scripture, but mm-hmm. some of the early church fathers, or even just some of the lives of saints that you read, they were really real people.
Right. It pushes you to confront that historical perspective.
Yeah. You think saint as a Protestant, and I don't know exactly what mode you have in mind, but it doesn't ever match with the stories that you see of these folks who struggle and mm-hmm. just, it's so refreshing to see.
Yeah.
To see that and that paid off.
Yeah.
But again, that goes to something that we've talked about so many times between us since then, is sometimes you can't see it till you see it and you allow yourself to see it. And I don't, you have a better way of putting that than I do. So I think I'll let you explain it, because I was the one there for months, weeks,
years.
I don't know. That was like, we've got to make this change, or I just can't handle certain things anymore. Right. Like, it just feels too wrong, right? Mm. There's too much sand.
Okay.
I don't know why I came up with that analogy, but...
Yeah.
It fits, though.
Yeah, it works.
And was just so irritated. Like, I need to make this change. And you weren't there.
I was not there. Yeah. Because my parents were our pastors.
Right.
And
right.
That's hard. When I told our priest that my parents were our pastors, he's like, oh my goodness, and you did this?
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
It was hard. It was hard to get
but
to that
But we did
point.
Have a rule, like... It wasn't going to be just one
right,
of us.
Right, we go together.
Yeah.
So when we finally got to the point where I was willing to say, okay, Lord, I'm just going, there are so many things I don't understand. There are so many questions mm-hmm. I have, but I think this is you leading us. So I'm just going to say yes. I'm going to say yes. We're going to do it. And I describe it as feeling like blinders fell off my eyes. Mm-hmm. And suddenly all these things that I thought were insurmountable questions mm-hmm. were not. Mm-hmm. Because I was willing to trust that there were answers.
Yeah.
Which I did not have to find myself. Mm-hmm. That I could trust they were there and that I would find them. And that if I'm believing that this is the church of God, then I can trust the church of God.
What were some of the main experiences that kind of brought you guys up to that ledge? You know, that really... You know, a couple of the main topics or questions or experiences that took you from rather comfortable in, you know, kind of your faith to this point where we have to really consider maybe there's a very different picture of Christianity than we once thought. How about we go with you first and then you, David?
Yeah.
So we'd mentioned that we were in charge of the education of our church. Yeah. So we had built a membership class in which we had people reading the church fathers. And because we were always taking the historical point of view.
Yeah.
And we had our church reading Clement in our Sabbath school lessons, which are basically Bible studies. Mm-hmm.
Which was really funny hearing some people like pray go and guide us through scripture. It's like, not quite scripture.
Yeah. But something we noticed time and time again is that we would be reading these, whether it be scripture or writings from early church fathers, mm-hmm. and we would have conversations and be leading people in conversations, and we would come to what we thought were, you know, new, deep understandings of things that were also very traditional understandings mm-hmm. of things. And people would agree in the conversation, and then as soon as the conversation was over, there was like a reset to default. And while we could reason to what baptism is through scripture, mm-hmm. the minute we stopped, it was back to, but it's just a symbol. Yeah. And it was like, That became a big irritant for us that we were clearly on a journey and they
no
were
one was
not
coming with
coming
us.
With
yeah,
us.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was years of this and having the conversations where we feel like God has led us down this path. And the further we went, the more breaks in relationship it was causing because they weren't coming with us. They didn't like where we were going. And the more we went there, the less happy our church was with us.
Sure.
So that just started.
They weren't happy with us. We weren't happy with them.
Yeah.
What were some of the topics that were the biggest bits of sand, you know, for you?
I'm trying to remember. Oh, the biggest bits of sand is a good question. Well,
communion was a big one.
It would be, yeah.
So how was that practiced or not practiced in your...
It was a once a month, if we remembered.
Okay.
And
if we remembered.
And it's really funny now, because I was also usually the one that did, like, the cleaning of the church and vacuuming mm-hmm. and those kinds of things. And I remember after days where there was communion, there were crumbs everywhere.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, we are just dirty, dirty people. And you know, one of the first things I thought about after converting was there would not be crumbs to vacuum up, like not like snow.
Right. That tells you a lot about, you know, what you actually believe, regardless of what you say, what you actually believe.
Yeah, they said the same words, right? Yeah.
They said the same words, but it's really just bread. Mm. And you pick the bread that'll be good as leftovers because it's just bread. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that was a big one because we studied the book of John. Mm-hmm. And when we got to John 6, we were both like, this is not symbolic, people. And they're like, oh, you're right. It's more than that. And then again, reset to default as soon as the conversation's over. It's just a symbol.
As Baptist, what was kind of the eschatological view and the view of the journey in terms of grace and works and sanctification? How did that kind of fall in your camp?
That's a good question.
I mean, well, for example, like, were you kind of the once saved, always saved
sort of mindset? It was mostly that. I mean, we would have conversations. Like, I don't think our particular church had one set point of view that we had established. Because in the Baptist, denomination, each church can set its own theology.
Sure.
There's the key points, right? You have to believe
it's Jesus. The Bible.
Yeah. Jesus came, died, rose again. And that's pretty much it. Everything else is up for debate. So we never set it out, but it was definitely leaning toward once saved, always saved. You made a decision for Christ, and then you were saved.
Yeah.
And I think that was another one of those irritants. Because it was clearly a case of, I thought we were working through things as a church, right? Like, to me, the church plant was always a journey, and the goal was always a sort of ecumenism, and it was always to end up with one universal church. And it took me years to realize I don't think most other folks were looking for that. They were looking for a place to come and, worship, but it didn't really go... There was no journey, right?
Right.
Like, you would reach this point, and I remember saying, you'd have visitors or like guest speakers come in, and they would talk about how bad their life was before they came to came to Christ, and now now I'm different. And I thought, are you? I mean, again, probably a bit judgmental, but like it reeked of not having self-awareness.
Well, and again, it begs the question. I mean, there's two key pieces of sand there. One is this question of, what is the shape of the Christian life? Because in the New Testament, it talks a lot about conversion, about turning, about changing. You know, that Christ seems to speak as if your actions and your words and your service matter, right? So that's a big piece of sand. Like, is this a journey or is it not? But then there's also the other piece of sand, which is that, how do we decide, right?
Yeah, who has the authority? That was a big question I asked all the time.
Yeah.
Who gets to decide? Who's the arbiter of your determination and this person's determination? And I remember one conversation was like, it would be nice to have a pope who may be able to come
somebody
in and break some of these ties.
Break some of the ties,
Or at the very least, like someone that you listen to that has some authority. And they're like, no, there can't be authority over my interpretation. How just self-centered, I have enough problem being self-centered without...
thinking that you are the ultimate interpretation of Scripture,
too. Yeah, exactly.
Which they wouldn't say that, but it's like...
But there is a Pope,
for all intents and purposes, it's just you.
Yeah.
It took me years to figure out that particular thought, too. And, I think one of the other strangely irritants, but it was on the other side, the more, prodding forward. We were at our friends Martin and Kimberly's wedding. You were... pregnant with our daughter, Zoe.
No, Rowan.
Rowan?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, it's out of time, One pregnancy is as good as the other. And we were there at their wedding reception, and I was talking to, I guess he was Brother Ezra at the time. He had not become Father Ezra. And
a college friend.
College friend. Yeah. We knew him as Randall Sullivan.
Yeah.
I was talking to his brother Michael, and it's like, it sounds like you're really close to converting. And again, this was,
2008.
Years ago at this point. And Father Ezra just looked at me and said, no, you're not. And I was taken aback, irritated, right? Like, what are you calling out? What are you saying I don't understand? And I think in retrospect, what he was saying was, you're not willing to trust. Mm. You're not willing to have that, what I'm thinking now of more like childlike faith. At the time, it was like, oh, you're saying that I'm not willing to give my will up to trust the church. It's like, well, that's probably fair.
Enough.
But he wasn't wrong.
Yeah.
He was the one phone call that I was sort of wanting to make and be like, oh, we're ready now.
You mentioned that during this time, during your time teaching, that other people were sort of picking up on this as well. What did other people think about these questions that you guys were having?
It depends on who you talk to. Some of them... We had people who would come up and thank us for asking hard questions and not accepting the kind of trite answers. And then there were other people who apparently were very offended that we would not just let them say something and leave it at that. And we're always pushing for more. And so, we were causing a split in the people. So, yeah.
In retrospect, I don't know if that was good or bad, but...
it was, right? It was part of the journey, right?
Yep.
Well, let's take a little break there, and we'll come back, and we'll kind of see how these questions resolved and moved you towards ultimately where you ended up.
Awesome.
We'll be back in just a couple minutes, so please stay tuned. I want to remind you that if you go to chnetwork.org, the Coming Home Network is a whole network of converts to the Catholic Church. So many of the men and women that we invite here on the show to share their stories are people that we've met through this network. And so if you are a convert to the Catholic Church, or if you're someone who's thinking about becoming Catholic, we want to support you in your journey. So go to chnetwork.org. You can sign up for our free newsletter there to know all about the different activities and services and resources that we have for you on your continuing journey. We'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of David and Roseanne's story. Stay tuned. See you then. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, speaking with David and Rosanna White. They're former Seventh-day Baptists. And I'm going to just mention one of the websites. They would share a few websites later on. But Roseanne A. White. No, Roseanne. I'm going to do this right. RosannaMWhite.com, where you can find out more about some of their projects. But when we left off, you know, you guys, after college, you were teaching together at this Full Gospel Seventh-day Baptist Church. And as you shared, you know, you've got some of these grits of sand that are beginning to be irritating in these questions. Other people are starting to pick up on it. So, you know, to begin with, just give us a little sense of some of the timeline of teaching there, and then we'll pick it back up with what kind of were some of the turning points that kind of propelled you forward. So you began teaching there.
Around probably 2006,
okay.
I think. Yeah.
2006.
Okay. That's probably when we were drafting some of the documents as a church plant. And, I remember a conversation I had. They sent, the denomination sent a person to come and help with a church plant, mm-hmm. and was drawing up the Constitution, and I had mentioned sacraments. Mm-hmm. And she said, Seventh-day Baptists don't do sacraments. And I went, really? You explain this to me. It's like, well, we wouldn't call them that. Mm. Okay. And another one of those moments where, okay, there's a hard stop on this conversation. We're going to move on to something else. But
yeah, and that was probably about 2013.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and, go ahead.
Yeah, so there were a lot of years of that. And then I am a historical fiction novelist. Mm-hmm. Fiction novelist, yeah. Historical fiction writer. Yeah. And I wrote a book that was set in 1914 to 1918 England, but I had a Belgian character who was Catholic. And so I wanted to make sure I was treating this character correctly. So
dangerous.
I know, it is.
Catholic because she had to be.
Because she's Belgian in the early 20th century.
Right.
This was not optional. I could not just make her some strange thing. So I reached out to my friend Rhonda, who we went to school with, and she is also a convert to Catholicism. Y'all have had her on the show. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, Rhonda.
This was Rhonda Ortiz.
Yeah.
Yes.
And she's also a novelist.
Yeah.
So I was like, Rhonda, can you read
Johnny.
This? Yeah. Can you read this for me and help me get all my Catholicism right? Mm-hmm. And so she said, oh, of course. So we had great conversations through the writing of the book, through as I was editing it and had her reading it. And there were those moments where she's like, you understand Catholicism. I see it with this line. And I'm like, really? Because I don't think I do. But thank you. I'm glad I got that line right. But it just kind of reestablished a relationship with her. And it wasn't long after that she and another Catholic writer, Karen Yulow, we're talking about how they would love to have a Catholic fiction press. And they started talking to us about it because we own a small publishing company.
Actually, they didn't even start talking to us about it. I remember reaching out to Rhonda and saying, I've been working with this new marketing method, and it seems like it would work really well with a group that has a strong cultural identity. Mm-hmm. It's like, would you think it would work well with the Catholic audience? You know, how would we, you know, do like what you did with The Number of Love? Which, you know, seemed to really touch mm-hmm. the Catholic community, because you were getting emails about...
When that book came out, I promptly started getting emails from readers saying, are you Catholic? Because there's not much Catholic fiction out there. And when I read this, I got so excited because, like, finally, a Catholic author. And I'm like, I'm not. but I'm glad it resonated so deeply with you.
So, yeah, I sent that email to Rhonda.
Yeah.
And she said, I can't believe you just asked me that. Karen and I were just talking about, because we're flippant when it comes to making business decisions sometimes, we're like, well, why don't we just start something? Mm-hmm. And so after a few months, we founded Chrism Press and started getting submissions of people who wanted to see their novels published. And
this at this same time, so we're talking to them almost daily probably at this point.
Oh, yeah.
And seeing their excitement, not just for this new endeavor, but for their faith and the nature of Catholicism that they wanted to bring out through fiction.
Even just working through the name as we were trying to pick out a name, right?
Yeah, how did you come to that name? Yeah.
Well, I don't even remember what all we went through, but it was...
We had a whole list.
Uh-huh. There was like, you know, what sort of sticks with our, you know, Spirit Meets the Page had been our company's sort of...
Motto
before.
Okay.
And what's the Catholic take on that? And it was like, oh, they came up with Anoint Your Imagination. I was like, okay. But then you start talking about the sacramental worldview, and that sacramental imagination changes a lot of...
Yeah.
It opens a lot of really interesting doors for fiction, and as fiction people,
it was huge. And it was at that same time that we were really having those irritants in the church where we were. And we would have meetings and try to do planning things, and we would, you know, try to guide things as we always did. And there was so much resistance and lack of enthusiasm in a lot of things. And then we would talk to Karen and Rhonda, where there's so much enthusiasm. And it just was a dichotomy that was very striking to us at the time, where we're having a lot more fun planning the Catholic press than we are, you know, trying to grow the Seventh-day Baptist Church. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I'd rather focus on that. I'd rather learn more about that. And so that pulled us in even more. And they thought it was hilarious that the first Catholic press dedicated solely to fiction was owned by Protestants. So they loved talking about that. But then it wasn't a whole lot longer after that where we're like, guys, you're going to have to stop saying that because we're coming along. We're coming on the journey.
So. That was a really fun call message. I don't even remember how you sent it, but
I think it was emails, but they were very excited.
Yeah. So. Well, what again, in terms of your continuing wrestling with these issues, the topics, I mean, what got you to that point where you're now getting ready to say to them, hey, guys, something's about to change? What were some of the clinching factors?
One of mine was a really funny one, because you've had Justin Hibbard on, and I had talked to him a few different times. He'd moved from Maryland to Pennsylvania, then out to Utah, so we hadn't seen each other in a while, and he was talking about how his journey had gone. And I remember him saying, I really like the organization and the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, but I just can't get over this Eucharist thing. And I went, really? Because that's the one thing that we're kind of on board with.
Yeah.
And I'm going to take total credit and say it's, you know, my conversation with him that day was...
Straightened him out
and sent him down the road to come here and eventually and, you know, just to come into the church. But that was a really interesting one for me, because if I can defend, you know, the core things of the church and say they're really important, like critically important, this thing that so many Protestant churches don't even have or acknowledge the existence of is the most important thing.
Right.
Why wouldn't you just do that?
Yeah. And it's the kind of thing where it can't be unimportant, right? It's got to be either the most important thing or really like nothing, you know, merely a symbol. It can't be something in between. You know, you can't really, as a Christian, you can't look at those verses and come away saying, you know, it's got to be one or the other, right?
I struggled with that for a long time because it was, okay, what is the Eucharist? Mm-hmm. Can we have it in our church? Is it about the words you say? Is it about, you know, what is it that makes it? And I could never solve that.
Yeah.
Without the church and without the sacraments and without the priesthood, you just, there's no real logical way around it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard enough with the church to really
wrap your head around it.
But I probably spent a year trying to figure out, okay, how can we have the more fullness of the church and slowly move toward that unity? Mm. And it just got to the point where You can't deny it anymore. I remember saying something like, we're either going to change or I'm going to give lip service and that's the end of the end of the thing. Like, I will show up, I will do my job, but I'm over it.
Yeah.
And like that was a really hard moment. And I think a lot of folks are having that hard moment now of I just can't anymore. And they're left really disheartened and, you know, agnostic or just they go and they sing the songs and they listen to the sermon and
it's not enough.
Yeah.
What did since one of the underlying threads here, of course, is this question of authority, what did it begin to look like for you, looking at the church and the hierarchy and the Pope? What did that look like as you're considering all these things?
It was something we really started to desire and want because, you know, we love reading the history and we even reading the Old Testament and reading then the early Christian philosophers. There's this idea of the seat of Moses, right? There's someone who talks to God or there's someone who's the ultimate authority who can answer the questions. And that is lacking in at least in our Protestant denomination. Others have more structure. But it was to the point where there would be occasions where things were said in church that we knew were not what we too believed, but there was no method for addressing it. And, you know, I could talk to my parents about it, but if they say, then that was it. That was as far as it could go.
Technically, there was a bishop, sort of.
But when we talked to him about it, he's like, well, there's nothing I can do. He's like, really?
What does your title mean?
Yeah.
So we just started really wanting some structure where, you know, if there's a disagreement, there needs to be an appeal system and there needs to be a hierarchy. There needs to be structure so that each church isn't doing its own thing. Yeah. We were doing a devotional with our family at the time that was meant to be ecumenical. And it was written by Catholics and Lutherans. And I don't know who else was in
there. It was very much, you know, Liturgy of the Hours based.
But the introduction to it was all about the one church and being ecumenical. And I had a funny line that I just will never forget, that Christ said he's coming back for his bride, not his harem. It's like, yes. Okay. So we were very much in the bent of ecumenism within the Christian faith and wanting that unified church. But for me, it became the question of where is that going to be?
Yeah.
Because I cannot imagine my Catholic friends ever saying, yeah, let's do it all together at the Seventh-day Baptist Church, because I knew we didn't offer what they needed. So I started asking myself, where can unity happen? Because it has to have a place. You can't unify all over, right? Like you have to unify in a particular place, being mindset, theology, understanding. Yeah. And I realized that it has to happen where Christ is. And where is Christ? He's in the Eucharist. He's in the Mass. And that's something we did not have in the Protestant Church. And we just developed a thirst for it.
And I mean, something else that sort of comes with that is we did discuss for quite a while, like Catholic versus Orthodox. And there were two sides, like even Chrism technically is, you know, ancient faith. So if there's an Orthodox perspective, we're not disinclined. But for a while, it was like, well, the Orthodox churches are a long way from here.
there was nothing.
And talking to other folks about it was, you know, well, they're somewhat, I think the word they used was a closed community. Like they're very cultural. Like, are you going to fit in? I don't know. So that was an interesting period of like, we know we want something ancient, but that's not even all that unusual for Protestants in some ways, right? Like this idea that you want to go back to the Acts Church.
Right.
Yeah. Of course, after the Acts Church and the apostles are gone, everything's up for grabs for some reason. It's like history stopped.
Yeah, it still begs the question of, you know, do we have not just an authority, but the kind of an authority that can see this community through time?
Well, that was the reason.
Yeah.
I still didn't want the authority, right? I was still bucking against that, even in that, well, the Orthodox Church doesn't claim to have an authority.
Yeah.
So there's still some autonomy. That's kind of cool, right? And, you know, I still really love a lot of the things that they do, but I think that the authority and like evolution happens, right? Like understanding
changes
and gets clearer, hopefully, most of the time.
Let's hope so.
As Newman said, it develops.
Right? Yeah,
exactly.
And I think that living in a living church was important.
Yeah.
So like balancing those ideas was,
yeah.
And in retrospect, coming back, looking at it, and you go, oh, the church has been balancing those issues since, you know, 30 AD or something, right? I mean, this is not no new ideas under the sun.
So how did you get to the point of actually deciding that you guys, it's time?
It involved politics, and it was during the pandemic. And so there were a lot of questions of how to handle things during the pandemic. And also as churches had to shut down and, you know.
That who has the authority question comes back.
Yeah. So there was a lot of, well, how are we making decisions? And what happens when I don't agree with the decision you are making and you don't like the decision I am making? And we started asking the question of, well, who gets to decide on policy? Yes, but who decides if we're doing a good job being Christians? Who decides if we're loving? Who decides all this stuff? And they did not like these questions. And we could not settle them there. And I think we just got to the point where it was like,
there was one particular conversation where there was almost so much relativism into it that was like, you just made the exact same argument that people make in favor of abortion, that it's your choice, that it's your, you get to make these decisions. It's like, I'm not sure I'm down with that. Well, I'm pretty sure I'm not down with that.
Yeah. Like,
there are places where it's your choice. You know, do you wear a blue shirt today or a brown shirt today? That's fine. But there are other things that are absolute.
We should not get to decide individually. Mm-hmm. So we had some hard conversations with my parents. They were actually really good conversations, too. And
you remember it a little differently in some ways.
So we talked about, you know, some of the things about, you know, COVID and politics and all that. But we also then talked about things like, you know, what do you think communion means? And here's what we think it means. And those are the conversations that I remember clearly. And he's like, I don't even remember saying
that. I remember some of it because so the Seventh-day Baptist Church, they like things like the Seder meal because they have a very Jewish look on things. And I remember we were talking about the Mass. And I was like, no, let me unspool this for you.
Yeah.
And I was like, wouldn't it be, I sort of framed it as, wouldn't it be great and beautiful if, you know, the Mass, or, you know, that communion existed out of space and time and all the parts were tied together. And you know, sort of tried to weave a picture.
Yeah, and that was how you put it, of what would the most beautiful be?
Yeah.
And
that was a fulfillment of the Old Testament.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, talking to my parents, saying, well, what do you think the most beautiful form of communion would be? They could say, yeah, it would be most beautiful if. And we're like, well, I believe that our God is a God of the most beautiful, right?
Now,
like,
if that exists.
If it exists, I want it.
That's a great way to put it, yeah.
But I think that had to be the moment, as unpleasant as... I've had people say, I can't believe that politics was a part of your conversion story. Well,
it sort of kind of was.
Sometimes it pushes you in a direction where you can't.
Yeah, and we
face
also
up those questions.
We have two kids, and they were both teenagers at the time.
That's true.
And so there was the constant, like every time we're coming home from a church function, we would be unpacking everything and talking things through. And it got to the point where our kids would lean forward and go, "Well, what's the Catholic or Orthodox view?" So we had trained them to the point of, well, we look into things, we research, and come to our own conclusions.
And even our kids were starting to go look things up and come back with answers
questions.
That's
beautiful.
And I think, again, it was still critical that we did something as a family. Mm-hmm. You know, when you read stories from folks like Scott Hahn, where he did it and that caused some problems, like, okay, great. It worked out. I'm happy for you. I can't live like that. I'm a bit of an absolutist in some ways. Like, we're either in this together or we're
and
we're not.
We were also a homeschool family. Yeah. So we had a friend who was like, really, your teenagers just came along? And I'm like, our teenagers always just come along. Yeah. They've been coming along since they were little because we always invited them, let's think it through, let's talk it through.
Right.
Let's have a conversation. What do you think? What do you think? And let's weigh them. So we basically said, look, we're going to do this as a family. You're going to come along. And if there comes a point where you're not on board, you need to say so. Mm-hmm. And so they were 16 and 13, not quite 14 yet at the time when we made the decision. And so the more we learned, we would do check-ins with them and be like, okay, guys, how you feeling? And our daughter was like on board, I think, wholeheartedly from day one, probably from day negative 15. And our son is a little quieter about it, but he loves that the Catholic Church is a church where you can reason through things. Mm. He was coming up against a lot of the anti-scientific side of fundamentalist, and not liking that. So he was relieved to be like, oh, I can believe in science in the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. Yay.
Yeah, in many ways, one way you can characterize the church throughout history is the church has always been a church of reality, right? And so it's never afraid of questions. Right? Yep. It's always ready for the questions. It always wants to dig deep. And you won't really find any other ideology or religion or philosophy in the world that is as Catholic in that sense. So open to that dialogue because we just want truth.
Yeah.
You've said a lot lately of if your faith can't handle anything that science comes out, it's your faith's problem, not the science's problem. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You don't need to change the science to fit your faith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because God is bigger. Don't put him in a box.
Yeah.
But you'll say that in a Protestant church, but do you believe... something you can say amen to? Can you stand on that?
Right. And how does it play out?
And not always prettily once you poke too hard.
Yeah. Well, where did you guys actually enter the church in 2021, right? I think it was.
Yeah.
2021. And we started going through the RCIA process. And it was interesting even thinking about the kids because they said, oh, well, maybe the younger ones will, we'll put with other kids. And Father James at the time was like, no, they got this.
Again, they were homeschool kids.
They're homeschoolers,
they were used to thinking through things. So yeah, we did all the classes as a family. Mm,
nice.
I think if there was any regret in retrospect, it was that we came into the church not at the vigil. But on the other hand, do I really want to wait 8 more months?
Yeah, and that was the thing. Whenever you express interest, they just start the program. So we came in September, actually.
Mm-hmm. Where was this at?
In Cumberland, Maryland.
Yeah, Our Ladies of the Mountain.
Okay.
Or Our Lady of the Mountains. I flipped the S.
Yeah. Yeah.
And very interesting historical parish. There, I was just talking to one of our priests there, and he said, there used to be 11 churches and 27 priests. There are now 8 churches and 7 priests.
Ooh.
And it's tricky, but they're Capuchin friars, so they always live in community, and it's really beautiful watching them be real people, but also like real holy people.
Yeah. And the fun thing is, so we started attending in October, probably beginning of November, actually. And so when we went to our first Christmas Eve service, we brought his mom, who had not been to a Catholic church in decades.
Yeah, 30 years at least.
And so the first service she went with us was the Christmas Eve. It was actually a midnight mass. And just the wonder on her face, because of course this is, there's the incense that night where ours does not do that very often. And she, just watching her face, she's like, it smells like church. And but she also leaned over and went, it's not in Latin. I can understand it. Because she left very soon after Vatican II and just
she'd gone back a couple of times, but not.
Yeah. So that was fun, too, that we've gotten to bring her back. She came with us.
Yeah.
So she's back in full communion with the church as well and comes with us all the time.
That was a funny day, though, because she had been coming and, not receiving communion. And I don't remember why Father Greg, who was the one who...
Our pastor,
and he came over and was talking to her, and she's like, well, I really just need, to go to confession. He's, you want to do it now? Yoink. And she disappeared. Okay. It's like, it didn't have to be a big thing, but she was agonizing over, how do I address this, this gap? And, I asked her, how did it go? She's like, I can only think of a couple things to say. Mostly it was that I didn't raise you in the church. So it's like
that works.
Yeah.
It's one of those great things you discover about the sacraments, right? Is that it's not about you or your willpower or being really smart or being really good memory. It's that you show up, you give what you have, and it's a matter of God's overabundant grace, right?
Yeah, I'm still not sure if I do any of it right.
But there's also the realization that we don't have to.
Right.
There's power in the sacrament itself. And
that was part of the issue of how do we have communion, proper communion in the church. And I was trying to find the answer.
Right.
And it is so nice to be like, I don't have to have an answer.
Yeah.
You should show up and the miracle can happen.
Yeah. Right. Amen. Well, we have just about 5 minutes left. And so, you know, things always look a little bit different in the church than as you begin to unpack this in your lives. And so, you know, let's make sure that both of you have a turn. What are some of the things that you've noticed since then? And what's kind of happened in terms of your family life and your work? We can begin with you, Roseanne.
It's amazing. I feel more at home. And I grew up in church. So church was always one of my homes. But it's just a profoundly different experience in the Catholic Church. And it all comes down to the Eucharist, right? Mm-hmm. And that's just, it's the center of everything. And there have been so many times, especially in the last year, I was going through cancer, where Jesus met me in the communion and, you know, healed minor irritants that I didn't even think to ask him to take care of. Just as I took the communion, nausea went away, things like that. And just so many times where I am so fully aware of Jesus is here. He is physically present. And that's what we always want, right? That's what every Christian wants, is to be with Jesus and realizing that I know where he is now. And he invites me to come every day if I want, definitely once a week have to show up for the family dinner. And just that realization that this is the central part of life. And it does that in such a beautiful way that it's rewritten everything. Yeah. And done it in such a way that I know it's not on me. I can just go and Jesus is there and I can meet him.
Amen. That's beautiful. What about you, David?
I think the biggest thing that goes back to that irritant still,
yeah,
but was that there were so many times where it's like, I just don't know if I can be sold out to this, right? Like, not the Catholic Church, but like the evangelical movement, the Seventh-day Baptist Church, like, I just can't give that same full-throated assertion that other people seem to be able to. And I thought that was like something fundamentally wrong with me. And once we came into the church, somewhere in the back of my mind, occasionally the idea would pop up like, you're going to hit that wall again. You're going to have that moment where you're like, no, I can't, I got to pull back. And it's never happened. There's never been a moment where I didn't want to go further, deeper, understand better, trust more, you know, like I never wanted to go to the Holy Land until we were watching something and there was, you know, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and those kinds of things. Like, I want to go have Mass there. Let's go. Like,
yeah.
And the realization now that there is something that you can stand on that's firm and the ground's not going to shift. Mm-hmm. And yet there are problems. Like, you know, it's one of those, every church has problems. I was irritated when Catholics I knew would say, well, the divorce rate is no worse in the Catholic Church than it is anywhere else. I went, guys, you got to be better than that. But now I'm of the mind of like, no, if the church screws up, it's on me. I get to apologize. I get to own that. I get to go deep with it. Right. So even the places of like penance for things that in theory I wasn't involved in, like, no, I'm like, let's own every part of it.
Yeah, it's one of those many great both ends of Catholicism. It gives you this stability to rest in knowing that the Holy Spirit guides the church and has authority. And so we kind of, that aspect of our searching can come to rest. But it also then calls us into this then ongoing, lifelong journey. Well, you continue going deeper in prayer, deeper in understanding, deeper in living out, you know, a virtuous, holy life. And so it's got the both and of the rest, but also the adventure.
Yeah, I love the both and.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, me too. Well, if people go to RosannaMWhite.com, they're going to remember it now. Yeah. What will they find about your guys' ongoing work? Yeah.
That's my author website, okay. So you'll find all of my books there.
Yeah.
And I also do teaching for writers. You can find it at classesforwriters.com.
Yeah.
Okay. Our publishing ventures are all at whitefire-publishing.com.
Okay.
And if you put a /read on that, you'll get all of our books in the store form. There are links there to Chrism Press, which is our Catholic line.
Or you can just go to chrismpress.com.
You can also just go to chrismpress.com for the... Yeah.
And if you're interested in getting in touch with me, just talk to her. We're in the same building most of the time.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. So many cool projects.
Yep.
Well, thank you guys for coming to share your story.
Thanks so much for having us.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And for your ongoing work. Again, we didn't get to talk about it much, but like certainly sharing good books as you guys experienced during school and helping other, you know, writers, people to find their voice in sharing the truth that they've encountered in their own stories is such an important thing. So thanks for doing that work. So thank you for joining us for this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that David and Rosanna's stories are being an inspiration to you. Remember, again, like as they mentioned there at the end, you know, we one of the great things about being Catholic that we have discovered as converts is this great both and. And there's many both ands in the church. The church kind of helps to guard these places of mystery, these places of apparent paradox. But one of them is that we find in the church a home, but also we find in the church a call to ongoing conversion. This side of heaven, we remain people on the journey. So let's keep each other in prayer as the journey continues. We'll be back again next week with another story. In the meantime, God bless.